Hello, and welcome to another in our ongoing series of interviews. We're talking about how to turn your renters into owners, finding keys to increasing accountability and engagement on your teams. My name is Tom Cooper, and this interview is brought to you by Bright Hill Group. Bright Hill Group is a coaching, speaking, and training company helping clients become better leaders. At Bright Hill Group, we believe that because people matter, we must lead them well. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Peter Bamberger. Dr. Bamberger holds a PhD from Cornell University in Organizational Behavior and Human Resource Management. Today, he's on the Faculty of Management at Tel Aviv University. He has many, many publications on topics related to engagement and employee satisfaction, and I am honored to have him here with me today. I think there are a number of areas that I think are interesting in this topic, but one of the things that I wanted to get your take on is I believe that giving employees the freedom to fail, you know, giving them the ability to do the job the way they want to do it is important. And Dan Pink wrote a book that was pretty popular. He talked about autonomy as a key to engagement in knowledge workers, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that.
Right. As soon as you give employees autonomy, you're giving them some discretion over what they do and how they do it. And if you tell an accountable leader that that's what you're doing, the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, you give an employee discretion, they're going to screw up, make a mistake, and I'm going to pay the price.
Right.
Right. So the question always is, how do you reduce the risk associated with autonomy? And one of the best ways to do that, I think, is to sort of predetermine the decision premises. And one way you can predetermine the decision premises by building an organization with a very strong normative framework that kind of brainwashes the employee and implants certain decision rules in their heads. So that on the one hand, you're giving them autonomy. On the other hand, it's kind of constrained autonomy that they won't screw up too badly because they're making their decisions given a set of premises that you lay out for them in advance. You understand?
I do. So I'm wondering then, what's the impact of that? Does the employee feel like they're being gamed at some level?
Not really. I mean, when we talk about strong cultures in organizations, that's what it's all about. These strong cultures become sort of a basis of control. And they're engaging cultures, and employees like these engaging cultures because it gives them a sense of control and of a sense of empowerment. You can call it to some degree manipulation, but you know, I'd be much happier working in that framework than working under a more traditional framework where I have a supervisor watching every move I make and I'm limited in terms of the discretion I'm afforded.
So what can organizations do to improve the strength of their culture? What do you see as keys to that?
They can look for inconsistencies in policies and practices, which confuse employees as to what the primary values are. They can try to hire employees that have normative fit right from the start. That's a hard one, but you can build systems of hiring that increase the likelihood that you're taking on employees that have a buy-in to the values that you as a manager think are really important to the organization. And reduce the degree to which you have to sort of train those people to accept those values afterwards. So there are a lot of systems to put in place. It's not really one-on-one. And, you know, a lot of focus on leadership is how you can improve the interaction between yourself and a given employee. But I think there's a lot more focus that has to be placed on how you build systems of employment that allow for these things to happen sort of by default without actual effort on the part of an individual leader or manager. So again, you ask, how do you build these cultures? Well, there are a lot of things in organizations, compensation systems that work in opposition to the kind of culture that you want to motivate. Like, give you an example, you're trying to develop a culture of cooperation and teamwork, but the compensation system is based on individual pay for performance, which transmits the message that, you know, my coworker's gain is my loss, and it's zero-sum gain in most organizations. There are a lot of things that we do in organizations that kind of confuse the message and weaken any type of culture that might be used as a basis for allowing us to better engage employees.
That's really interesting. I mean, I certainly have observed that in my work experiences, that some organizations did a good job of telling stories and leading us kind of down the path, and other organizations really struggled to be able to do that effectively.
Right. It's very hard to be consistent. It's really hard.
But I'm curious to know your thoughts about setting clear, measurable goals and communicating them, and how that's tied to engagement?
Well, there's a whole literature on goal setting, which you're probably familiar with, right? The work of Locke and Latham. There's this guy named Ed Locke, who used to be now emeritus, lives in California. But he developed a theory of motivation, which was based on setting goals, and ran a whole bunch of experiments. And if there's any theory in organizational behavior that's been tested again and again and again with consistent results, it's goal setting theory. And the idea is that we enhance employee motivation, call it engagement if you want, to the degree that goals are specific, measurable, somewhat challenging but not exceedingly challenging, and participatory, that they're set in a participatory manner, that the person that you're working with, I mean, it's the basis of MBO, management by objective.
Mm-hmm.
But I encourage you to look at this literature. He's got books out there, articles. I mean, this is one of the most well-studied areas in the organizational behavior, how important it is to set goals and what type of goals, what are the characteristics of goals that that are most associated with what they call motivation, what you're referring to as engagement, a sense of feeling commitment to what you're doing and working hard at it.
My experience has been that it is very helpful if you can get that. But again, most organizations that I've dealt with do a really poor job of setting goals and an even poorer job of communicating expectations to employees.
Right. The goals change all the time and they set moving targets, which is about the worst thing you can do for employees. Especially
right.
When you reward on the basis of those moving targets. Because they're not specific goals, they're not stable goals, and it's very hard for people to commit to something that's moving.
Right, right. How do you know when we get there? How do you know how we're doing?
Exactly. That's the measurable side of it as well. Yep.
So the other kind of area that I was interested in digging into with you a little bit was around recognition.
Okay.
I think in the U.S., we typically think in terms of compensation. You know, it's raise or bonus or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And my opinion is that for knowledge workers who are already making, past a certain level of income where they're not worried about making the mortgage, that's less effective than more direct connection and communication with, on a more personal level. Looking at those more soft skills, specific praise, either public or private, increased responsibilities, those kinds of things. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, it's been debated for years, and there are various perspectives on it. Let's put it this way. I don't buy the argument that beyond a certain point, money doesn't matter, because one of the important rules in compensation is that we always engage in social comparison, and how much you make and your satisfaction with how much you make is very much a function of how much those around you are making.
Hmm.
So even if you're very comfortable with how much you're earning, you're never fully comfortable because you're always looking at how much the next guy is making. And there are lots of points of comparison. It could be other guys in the organization. It could be other guys in the same type of position outside of your organization. And it could be looking at other people doing very different things in your own organization, like your boss or the CEO. And then the analysis is, what's my contribution relative to their contribution, and is that difference justified? So just because a knowledge worker is making tons of money doesn't mean that the basis for motivation or for engagement should shift from money to something else. Well, everything I was just talking about is this notion of equity, of fairness, okay? So
mm-hmm.
Equity is the basis upon which we build compensation systems in most organizations. Equity, perceived equity by itself, is not necessarily going to breed engagement. But the absence of it certainly will limit engagement and likely will motivate problems in retention. People will leave.
Sure.
So just by looking at the absolute level of pay or total compensation, you can't make any claims as to how engaged people are going to be, or that the way to get them engaged is to focus on other aspects of work or relationships or feedback or challenge at work. That the equity element has to be there. If the equity element is there, the perceived equity is what matters, not the actual objective equity. If the perceived equity is there, then yeah, I think one of the ways to enhance commitment, enhance retention, and enhance engagement is, for knowledge workers at least, is to focus on challenge. Because people that become knowledge workers are typically people that are motivated by challenge, otherwise they wouldn't have gone into that area. So constant learning experiences and constant ego trip in a lot of cases make a big difference, but only on the basis of an equitable pay system.
That's a very good point. I mean, you know, one of the things I saw, I worked for a large company in the U.S., and there was a disconnect within the corporate expectations. Within the company, we don't pay that much. We, you know, the market doesn't demand that much. There's a certain cachet with being associated with this organization. People want to work here. We don't have to pay what others pay. And it was very difficult to be competitive.
Right. Again, it depends what the benefit of working in that organization is. If the benefit is the organization in graduate school, you know, it trains people and provides a lot of human capital, but it doesn't reward people, that human capital, and at a certain point, people are going to say, thanks, I got enough of the human capital now, now I'm going to take it out into the market where it pays, right? So that notion of rewarding people on the basis of enhancing their knowledge works only up to a certain point. Now, you can always say that what we'll always do is keep you engaged in the organization to the point that you're no longer in the internal tournament within the organization. In other words, we'll reward you more if the competencies that we've helped you develop are greater value to us and we think you have more to contribute in the future. And the ones that don't play in the tournament in the future, we don't think should be playing in that tournament in the future, we're not going to pay any more than we have to, and they can take the knowledge that we've, you know, given to them elsewhere. It's somewhat short-sighted because your competitors can get that knowledge and use that against you. But that isn't, you know, that is a reasonable approach.
Yes, I certainly observed that approach when I was working for Pricewaterhouse, that they said, as long as we see you're up, you know, you're going to move up or you'll move out, that we don't really care about the longevity or keeping you unless you're going to continue to move up in the organization.
Sure. Yeah. If they have no room for you to move up, then after they've gotten their return on their investment, any increased pay that they give you is basically reduced return to them, and they're probably better off getting the same knowledge from a lower paid person and making the most of them for a while. I did do a piece where we looked at how much control you give to employees to choose which projects they to work on, not only how to do work, but not only autonomy on how to do your job, but which job to do. There was a paper I did with a doctoral student of mine named Michal Biron that was published in a journal called Human Relations. And it was actually a study that was financed by you've heard of Slidell?
I have not.
Slidell is a company that makes the software for call centers that routes calls in call centers.
Got it.
Okay. So this was a company that wanted to develop some sort of technology where the call center employees could actually choose which kind of calls they wanted to take. Okay, so it wasn't only the customer, it wasn't only routing the calls on the basis of optimizing the utilization of the call center agents, but the idea was that you'd empower employees. Mm-hmm. So the algorithm would include the interests of the employee and not just the interests of the organization. And in that sense, it was a matter of how letting employees sort of deploy themselves. Mm-hmm. And we tested a model of that using in a sort of a call center lab. We created our own little call center and watched what happened in terms of a whole bunch of different outcomes.
So
in the end, the company, even though we demonstrated that it worked, the company was never able to sell the product, and I think it shut down.
But it was
fun to do.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the company doesn't have an immediate vested interest in satisfying the desire of the worker.
Except a lot of these call center companies do, because the turnover rates are extremely high. They're 50% or higher in most call centers.
Hmm.
And people get burnt out very quickly, and we weren't able to demonstrate in terms of turnover, because this was in a laboratory context, but a lot of the other consequences that are associated with high turnover,
mm-hmm.
we were able to demonstrate that you can resolve by giving the call center employee a bit of control over what calls they take.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think all these topics are fascinating, you know, trying to understand kind of how we work, and we're so complex.
Right.
Okay. So my background is technology, and one of the things that I observed is that a lot of times technical people initially in their career are on a sort of Pavlovian model that says the more technology you learn, the more compensation you'll get, and the more we value
Right.
you and the more compensation. And then that works until they're a few years into their career, maybe 5 or 7 years into their career, where there's a shift to say, and now what we need you to do is we need you to focus on making, you know, leading people or influencing teams or defining projects as opposed to technical contributions. And
Right.
it seems like that's a big area of frustration in the technology professionals' world. And
Right.
so what do you think might be some things that organizations could do to try and attack that to make that more, make it less painful for folks as they're moving up in their career?
Well, first of all, not everybody who wants to advance and move up in their career has to go into that route. So one of the ideas is creating dual career ladders mm-hmm. where it is possible to progress without having to take on a managerial role, and you can make as much money staying in the technical role. We have that in academia. We've got academics that, and if you look at any university, the way it works is that once you become, you know, a full professor or something, you're kind of pushed to take on administrative positions, but there are plenty of really good scientists in all the different departments that are lousy managers.
Yes.
They tend not to want to go that route, and the trick of a university is to figure out how to compensate them in such a way that they stay at their university and not move to other universities without having to take on administrative roles. So organizations can do the same thing, and IBM has been very, very successful, for example, in doing that by creating this, you know, this track towards IBM Fellows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
yes.
IBM has a... for many, many years, for 20 or 30 years, we've had this this system put in place. But so that's step one. And step two is for the those that do want to become managers, there needs to be a system in place to allow them, people that are willing to become managers, some of them do need to become managers, probably. There's got to be a mechanism in place to train them to do that. And a lot of companies are developing these systems for high potential. These high potential programs are very much in that technology-driven company, because the companies are realizing that these high potentials don't just become leaders. There's some knowledge that you gotta give them to be able to become leaders and good managers. A lot of them has to do with simple tools of execution. So the guy that I work with at Cornell, Sam Bacharach, has, you know, a leadership program which is very much based on sort of the micro skills of execution.
Sort of the fundamental skills for being successful?
Yeah, so if you take an engineer and you want to turn them into a leader in an organization, you can't just assume that you promote them and they'll sort of learn over time how to become a leader.
Right.
Some of them will. The vast majority won't, right?
Yes.
But luckily, if you start analyzing what's involved in being an effective manager, or even better, being an effective leader in an organization, there are a bunch of skills that one can master through learning. And organizations have to adopt a learning model which is based on that skill set. And there are organizations that provide, you know, that have different perspectives on what that skill set is. And that's what high potential leadership programs are structured around. But
what's interesting to me is that there's so little connection. I mean, if you're manufacturing widgets or, you know, whatever, the challenge is that the people who are passionate about the widget aren't so concerned with the human factors piece. They're really concerned with what do I have to do minimally on the human factors side to be able to maximize the number of widgets or the amount of software or whatever it is I'm creating.
Right.
And so it's about helping them to recognize that they have an enlightened self-interest, if you will, in adopting some intentionality about saying, let me look at how I can develop the people on my team to have the skill set that I need. But it seems like there's a fairly low level of awareness about the need. They don't perceive that that's important, which is, I find, shocking.
Right. But I think there's a lot of... I know that the work that Sam Bacharach does is very much based on sort of political models of leadership and understanding that in order to execute, you've got to sort of be like a politician in an organization and identify interest groups and build coalitions and
wrote a book called, he wrote actually two books. One is called Get Them on Your Side, and the other one is Keep Them on Your Side. And a lot of the stuff that he does is based very much in those very, very fundamental skills of political competence as a basis for execution of the management. And that's the kind of stuff that you can't assume that an engineer kind of just knows. And again, it's the kind of thing you can learn over time as a manager, or you can kind of take a quick route and teach people about that stuff and hopefully get them in a position where they can leave within a matter of months as opposed to years.
Well, thank you so much. Sure. I really appreciate
it. Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I also want to thank Dr. Bamberger for joining us, and I know that we all appreciate the great ideas he has shared with us. This has been a fantastic discussion. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did too. If you'd like more information on this topic, please let us know. We have a special report with 6 keys to improving accountability and ownership on your teams. For a copy of this report, please send an email to engagement@brighthillgroup.com. That's engagement@brighthillgroup.com. Or if you'd like some help, or even just have some questions, please give us a call, 240-668-4799. That's 240-668-4799. For Bright Hill Group, this is Tom Cooper signing off. Looking forward to seeing you all again soon.